The Colbrin. 2. The Book of Gleanings. Being writings from various old Qaldi books, which were partially destroyed in ancient times. Chapter 3. The Flood of Atuma. Behold, was this not written in the days of our fathers' fathers and of their fathers before them, and given unto us that we should pass it into you, the children of days yet unborn? That if the ability of the scribe remains with you, it could be read in your generation. Read, O children of the unborn years, and absorb the wisdom of the past which is your heritage. The enlightening words from a past which is to you, in days so far away and yet in truth so near. We are taught that we live forever, and this is true, but it is equally true that no moment of life must be wasted, for each hour and day on earth is a shaping for the future. We are the inheritors of a portion of time, we can dissipate it on futile things or utilize it to our everlasting benefit. In the days of our fathers, before barren teachings clogged the thoughts of men, and vain, formal ritual built a wall which obscured understanding, men walked in the light of truth. Then they knew there was one God alone, but because they allowed their higher abilities to fall to disuse, they saw less clearly. Because he appeared in different aspects, they thought he was many. Now, in our days, God has many varied forms in the eyes of men, and each declares he alone knows the true name and likeness of God. Here all men fall into error, though all have spoken truly according to their understanding. But truth can never bow to the limited understanding of man, the comprehension of man must expand to grasp it. In olden times there were spawned great monsters and beasts in fearful form, with frightful gnashing teeth and long ripping claws. An elephant was but a cat in comparison with them. Then, because of heavenly rebellion and turmoil, and the terror overwhelming the hearts of men, the Great One hardened the face of the land, which had become unstable, and the beasts were changed to stone. This was before times, when the destroyer still slumbered in the upper vaults of heaven. Thus, it is written in the record of Belcherra, in those days the people were wicked, and though the wise men among them gave many warnings of the wrath to come, they would not listen, such is the way of the wicked. So it came about that the chastening spirit became stirred up against them because of the odor of wickedness arising from the earth, for her nostrils abhor the smell of evil. This is a smell no man can know, for as the hounds know the smell of fear, which no man can detect, so can other beings know the smell of wickedness. The great floodgates which are above earth were all opened. Thus, the flood waters rose up to cover the land, and great rainstorms lashed down. The winds could no longer discover their destinations. The people left the plain of Shinara and fled up into a great mountain rising above the flatlands below, and here, near the summit, they camped. Feeling themselves secured, the wicked mocked, saying, "No water can ever reach up here, for there is not enough of it in heaven or earth." Still the waters rose ever higher, and the mouths of the wicked were silenced. The priests of the people danced and chanted in vain, and many rituals were performed to appease the wrath above. There came a period of quietness, then the people built a gateway to heaven wherein the chief of interpreters might commune with the other realm. He entered into the silence and cast his spirit, and when he had done so it contacted the chastening spirit which men call by other names. Her voice was heard within his heart, and it said, "I am that which has been called forth by the odor of wickedness arising from the bodies of men, which no incense can disguise. For as the smell of putrefaction assails the nostrils of men, so does wickedness give forth something which assails us in this realm. Wickedness is, therefore, an offense against us. If a man threw filth over the wall into your courtyard, would you not consider this an act of hostility? Could any among you live in harmony with those who were insensitive to your own sensitivity? Thus, I am awakened to happenings in the world of men, and am now clothed in a performing substance." The spirit being said, "I have no desire to unduly punish men. Go out to the people and tell them that if they will but mend their ways and walk no more in the path of wickedness, I shall depart." But when the chief of interpreters returned to the people, he found them fearful and distraught, clay in the hands of false priests, devotees of the baleful gods. The false priests were crying out for a sacrifice to their gods and had seized Anis, a young man more handsome than any other, a messenger and runner between cities. Then, though they whispered fearfully among themselves concerning the deed, the people had seized Nanyua, handmaiden of Iloma, the enlightened one, whose life was dedicated to Ilana, for she had cried out curses upon their heads when the young man was taken. Nanyua and Anis were held by the false priests and about them surged the great mass of the people, and though the chief of interpreters raised his voice it went unheeded. Then the mass of the people moved down to the water's edge and there they stopped while the priests shouted prayers to the gods raging above. All the heavens were darkened with great rolling clouds and there were high winds and lightning about the mountain top. The people rent their garments, the women wailed and men struck their forearms. Anis was beaten with a club and delivered to the waters. Then, as he who wielded the club turned towards Nanyua, she said to those about her, "Let be, I will deliver myself to the waters, for if I must be sacrificed I would be a better sacrifice so given." Then she went down to the waters, but as her feet entered she drew back from the cold dark watery depths before her. But as the one who wielded the club moved forward, a young man, Shilue the scribe, a man of quiet ways, neither handsome nor strong in body, pushed forward and, taking her by the hand, went down into the waters with her. The waters had risen high and men shared the place where they stood with wild beasts and with sheep and cattle, but now the tumult quietened and the waters drew back. Seeing this, the people shouted praises to the baleful gods and cried out, "Great are the mighty gods, and great their holy priests." The chief of interpreters went sorrowfully apart, hiding himself, for now he was fearful for his life. When the waters had subsided, he cast his spirit and entered into communion with the chastening spirit, and he said, "Shall I also enter the falling waters as a sacrifice? For life is now futile, as I am without God or honor." The Great One answered, "Men see in events the things they wish to see, they can interpret only according to their understanding. The waters rose to their limitations and did not fall because of the needless sacrifices. The powers above may ordain events to chasten men, but more often such events are challenges and tests. However, divine intervention is rare indeed. These priests follow another, a longer path, but they too condemn wickedness and they too point the way to truth, though that way may be indirect and beset with hazards. So whether they or you reached the ears of the people, the odor of wickedness will be diminished. Divine ends are achieved by diverse means, and the eyes of few men are open to see either the means or the end. Life is never futile, but your sacrifice would be. No man can lose his God, for he is always there, but the prestige of a man because of that God, such prestige is a worldly thing of little real value. How do you know whether you have lost or gained? Events of the moment cannot be weighed in the moment, but can be assessed only by the judgment of the years. Only eternity knows whether this or that was good or bad, a gain or loss." Then the Great One opened the eyes of the chief of interpreters, so he saw beyond the earthly border into the realm beyond. Behold, he saw Anis, who had been strong and handsome on earth, and now he was something not pleasant to gaze upon. He saw also the true beauty of Nanyua, who was now a being of dazzling loveliness, and beside her was Shilue, who had always loved her secretly, and he was now glowing with youth and handsome as Heleth. The chief of the interpreters then understood that evil could be transmuted into good, and that men had little knowledge of the true nature of things. Upon the mountain there is now a grove of trees and a temple built in the form of a circle of white stones, where the people remember the day of their deliverance. But what they recall and what happened are not the same, nor is the cause in their minds the true cause. They say, "We are the children of Atuma who saved us." Many who have gone often to the temple of deliverance say they have seen two shades, one radiantly beautiful and one gloriously handsome, wandering hand in hand through the trees or sitting in the sunlit glades. All about is now a place of peace. Men walk under the shadow of dread and fear of unknown powers fills their hearts. They have fashioned images in the likeness of the things which frighten them in the gloom of their ignorance, and they spurn the real for the unreal. Did they see more clearly, they would know that the things they fear are but gentle and sturdy hands which can lead them to fields of contentment. Back to the deluge, legends, myths, History. Chapter 4. The Deluge. It is written, in the great book of the Firehawks, that earth was destroyed twice, once altogether by fire and once partially by water. The destruction by water was the lesser destruction and came about in this manner. The people of those times spurned all spiritual things and men lived only for pleasure, caring little for the good of mankind or the future of the people. Lewdness and lies were upon the tongues of all men and brother could not deal justly with brother. The princes and governors were corrupt and proper tribute was not paid, the statues were held up to scorn. The lives of men were ruled by their desires and they spent their days in gluttony, drunkenness, fornication, dancing and singing to instruments of music. The land was unattended, for men dissipated their strength in unproductive lusts and pleasures. Women lacked shame, for many would cast their glances after one man. Men fought among themselves and even slew one another because of their lusts for worthless women, while the chaste women were not sought. They were even rejected, for men declined the effort of being worthy of them in the eyes of their fathers. Wives were unhonored and only the women of pleasure commanded the attentions of men. Women were unclean and immodest and men lay with them shamelessly in the presence of one another. Old women were more lustful than the young ones, while virgins were seduced and corrupted in their childhood. Fathers fornicated before their sons and were admired for their prowess. They made no distinction between their sons and other men, or between their wives and other women. Deceit and violence were seen on every hand. To the east and north were high mountains upon which dwelt a tribe called the sons of Nezerah, the men of the mountains, who were hardy men and mighty hunters, skillful in the chase and valiant in battle. The men were upright, their wives were faithful and their sons noble. In their hearts were no unworthy thoughts, no envy or hate, no malice or deceitfulness. They did not smile before a man's face, uttering smooth words, then when he turned his back reach out to stab him. In their wives and daughters there was no impure longing, and neither cursing nor lying was heard among them. The womenfolk respected their men and maintained decency and decorum. Yet they were men with men's ways, abhorring all forms of unmanliness and degeneracy. Therefore, the treasures in the cities of the plains and the weakness of the people to whom these belonged did not go unnoticed by the sons of Nezerah. So they said among themselves, "Let us go down and do a good deed among these people, let us show them the ways of men who are strong, making them slaves and possessing ourselves of their goods." This talk continued among the men in the marketplaces and gatherings, until they were stirred up to deeds, and they gathered together a warband of fighting men. The mountain men chose leaders from among themselves, after their custom, and prepared to fall upon the soft-living people of the plains and become their masters. When the chiefs of the mountain men saw what was happening, they became wroth and ordered their men to return to their flocks and pastures. The chief of chiefs stood up before the gathered warband and said, "It is our decree that this thing shall not be done, you must not go down from these mountains bringing the sword to these people. Leave them alone, as rotted fruit is left on the tree to wither and die. Leave them to follow their own ways a little longer and in the fullness of time they will destroy themselves. Make no widows among your own people. If you go down there carrying fire and sword, you may find a trap laid for you among the flesh pots. The attraction of their pleasure and the temptations of their luxury is, to strong men such as you, like the lure the flame has for the moth. Do not lay yourselves open to destruction, even though the manner of its accomplishment be pleasant. If you must destroy this people, then destroy utterly so nothing remains. They are many while we are few, and though by the keen hard-hitting sword we may prevail in battle, yet might we not be lost under a deluge of soft feathers. Will you be wise enough to sup on milk and honey without being drowned in it?" For a time the fighting men heeded the words of their chiefs, for they were neither willful nor reckless, but there were some among them who went down to the plains in peace. They returned with tales of treasures and pleasures awaiting below, reporting that the time was ripe for an attack, the war men hired by the lowlanders having departed. For in those days the gods of Sharapik strove against the gods of Elishtar and Ladek. Then the fighting men disregarded the commands of their chiefs and, choosing war captains from among themselves, went down and fell upon the people of the plain. The people of the plain bowed before the strength of the men of the mountains. They did not fight, for among all their possessions they regarded their lives as the most valuable thing, precious above all else. They said, "Take whatever we have, our riches and harvests, the treasured things from our dwellings, even our daughters for your amusement, but leave us enough that we may live under your shadow." The sturdy men of the mountains were sickened by these half-men who had lived for three generations without fighting, and they despised them. The battle-hardened men who had come down from the highlands took whatsoever they desired. The plainsmen demurred, but because their stomachs turned to water before the virility of their conquerors, their protestations were words of wind. The victors clothed themselves in plundered finery and indulged themselves in the wines and delicacies of the food tables. They slept in beds of luxury and dissipation, every want being attended to by the vanquished. They learned the ways of sensuality which goes with soft living, and when sated with natural pleasures some lightened their boredom with unnatural ones. The mountain men saw that the women of the cities were beautiful but they were not modest, casting their charms before the masters, unashamed, so it followed they were taken when required and treated as chattels. The women did not complain, though hitherto they had stood equal with their menfolk, but woman's equality with half-men is not something of value. With women like this the men placed no restraint on their lust and went from excess to excess. The women, rejoicing in the strength and vigor of the men, said among themselves, "Here are men indeed such as we have not known before." Then, in the manner of women, they turned away from their own men and from the households of their husbands and fathers, for now they despised them. They threw off all womanly restraint and grappled with the victors like ravening beasts, and the strong were vanquished by weakness. Always do women behave thus when their menfolk are defeated in battle, it is for this men fight. None came to do battle with the victors, for they who had fought for the gods had destroyed themselves and in the fullness of time the victors, too, were destroyed by the fleshpots, by fornication and drunkenness, by ease and luxury. Their fighting strength and valor departed with the passing years, they grew fat and slothful. They who had come down in manly array to fight and win, who could not be challenged in battle by the lesser men of the plains, were eaten up in the mansions of pleasure, in the drinking booths, with music, wine, and fine linen. Upon the mountain and in the mountain homes there was weeping and sadness among the women. Fields were untilled and cattle strayed away, sheep went unplucked. The best craftsmen were gone and few remained willing to learn their skill, the teachers of learning taught no more. The gnarled hand that had wielded the sword and terrorized the foe now plucked the strings of psaltery and lyre. The rough jerkins and corslets were cast off and now garments were of fine linen dyed purple and crimson. Men arrayed their softening bodies in gaudy attire and bathed in scented waters. They rejected their own women for those of the cities whose hands and feet were stained with bright colors and whose faces were marked with blue. One day, from afar off came three men of Ardis, their country having been stricken by a mountain burst. They were worshippers of the one God whose light shines within men, and when they had lived in the two cities for a number of days they were stirred up in their hearts because of the things they saw. So they called upon their God to see these evil things. Their God sent down a curse upon the men of the cities, and there came a strange light and a smoky mist which caught at the throats of men. All things became still and apprehensive, there were strange clouds in the skies and the nights were hung with heaviness. Many days passed before a north wind came and the skies cleared, but then, when women conceived they bore devils. Monstrosities came forth from their wombs, whose faces were terrible and whose limbs were unproportioned. In those days men knew the art of working clay and making linen in bright colors, and also the use of eye paint. They had knowledge of herbs and magic, of enchantment, and the wisdom of the Book of Heaven, the knowledge of signs and omens, the secrets of the seasons, of the moon and the coming of the waters. The remnants of the sons of Nezerah remained upon the mountains which are against Ardis, by the land about the encampment of Lamech. In Ardis there were wise men filled with the inner wisdom, who read the Book of Heaven with understanding and knew the signs. They saw that the deeds of men in all the lands about the mountains had brought them to their hour. Then the day came when the lady of the night changed her garment for one of a different hue, and her form swept more swiftly across the skies. Her tresses streamed out behind in gold and copper, and she rode in a chariot of fire. The people in those days were a great multitude, and a loud cry ascended into heaven. Then the wise men went to Sherpak, now called Sarepesh, and said to Susuta, the king, "Behold, the years are shortened and the hour of trial draws nigh. The shadow of doom approaches this land because of its wickedness, yet, because you have not mingled with the wicked, you are set apart and shall not perish, this so your seeds may be preserved." Then the king sent for Hanok, son of Hagaretur, and he came out of Ardis, for there he had heard a voice among the reeds saying, "Abandon your abode and possessions, for the hour of doom is at hand, neither gold nor treasure can buy a reprieve." Then Hanok came into the cities and said to the governors, "Behold, I would go down to the sea and would therefore build a great ship, that I may take my people upon it. With me will go those who trouble you, and they will take the things which cause you concern, therefore, you will be left in peace to your own enjoyment." The governors said, "Go down to the sea and build your ship there, and it will be well, for you go with our blessing." But Hanok answered, "It has been told to me in a dream that the ship should be built against the mountains, and the sea will come up to me." When he had gone away, they declared him mad. The people mocked him, calling him commander of the sea, but they did not hinder him, seeing gain in his undertaking. Therefore a great ship was laid down under the leadership of Hanok, son of Hagaretur, for Susuta, king of Sarepesh, from whose treasury came payment for the building of the vessel. It was built on the lake of Nemos, close by the river of gold, where it divides. All the household of Hanok was there, and the household of his brother who directed the men at the task. Dwivan, captain of ships, from the land beyond Ardis, was overseer of the craftsmen. The women and children carried and the men built. The length of the great ship was 300 cubits, and its breadth was 50 cubits, and it was finished off above by 1 cubit. It had 3 stories which were built without a break. The lowermost was for the beasts and cattle and their provender, and it was laid over with sand from the river. The middle one was for birds and fowls, for plants of every kind that are good for man and beast, and the uppermost one was for the people. Each story was divided in twain, so that there were 6 floors below and 1 above, and they were divided across with 7 partitions. In it were cisterns for water and storehouses for food, and it was built with Askara wood, which water cannot rot or worms enter. It was pitched within and without, and the cisterns were lined. The planks were edged and the joints made fast with hair and oil. Great stones were hung from ropes of plaited leather, and the ship was without mast or oars. There were no poles and no openings, except for a hatch beneath the eaves above whereby all things entered. The hatch was secured by great beams. Into the great ship they carried the seed of all living things. Grain was laid up in baskets, and many cattle and sheep were slain for meat which was smoked by fire. They also took all kinds of beasts of the field and wild beasts, birds and fowls, all things that crawl. Also gold and silver, metals and stones. The people of the plains came up and camped about to see this wonder, even the sons of Nezerah were among them, and they daily mocked the builders of the great ship, but these were not dismayed and toiled harder at the task. They said to the mockers, "Have your hour, for ours will surely come." On the appointed day, they who were to go with the great ship departed from their homes and the encampment. They kissed the stones and embraced the trees, and they gathered up handfuls of the earth, for all this they would see no more. They loaded the great ship with their possessions, and all their provender went with them. They set a ram's head over the hatch, pouring out blood, milk, honey, and beer. Beating upon their breasts, weeping and lamenting, the people entered the great shop and closed the hatch, making it secure within. The king had entered, and with him those of his blood, in all 14, for it was forbidden that his household go into the ship. Of all the people who entered with him, 2 understood the ways of the sun and moon and the ways of the year and the seasons. 1 the quarrying of stones, 1 the making of bricks, and 1 the making of axes and weapons. one the playing of musical instruments, one bread, one the making of pottery, one the care of gardens and one the carving of wood and stone. One the making of roofs, one the working of timbers, one the making of cheese and butter. One the growing of trees and plants, one the making of plows, one the weaving of cloth and making of dyes, and one the brewing of beer. One the felling and cutting of trees, one the making of chariots, one dancing, one the mysteries of the scribe, one the building of houses and the working of leather. There was one skilled in the working of cedar and willow wood, and he was a hunter, one who knew the cunning of games and circus, and he was a watchman. There was an inspector of water and walls, a magistrate, and a captain of men. There were three servants of God. There was Hanok and his brother and their households, and Dwivan, and six men who were strangers. Then, with the dawning, men saw an awesome sight. There, riding on a great black rolling cloud came the destroyer, newly released from the confines of the sky vaults, and she raged about the heavens, for it was her day of judgment. The beast with her opened its mouth and belched forth fire and hot stones and a vile smoke. It covered the whole sky above and the meeting place of earth and heaven could no longer be seen. In the evening the places of the stars were changed, they rolled across the sky to new stations, then the flood waters came. The floodgates of heaven were opened and the foundations of earth were broken apart. The surrounding waters poured over the land and broke upon the mountains. The storehouses of the winds burst their bolts asunder, so storms and whirlwinds were loosed, to hurl themselves upon the earth. In the seething waters and howling gales all buildings were destroyed, trees were uprooted and mountains cast down. There was a time of great heat, then came a time of bitter cold. The waves over the waters did not rise and fall but seethed and swirled, there was an awful sound above. The pillars of heaven were broken and fell down to earth. The sky vault was rent and broken, the whole of creation was in chaos. The stars in the heavens were loosened from their places, so they dashed about in confusion. There was a revolt on high, a new ruler appeared there and swept across the sky in majesty. Those who had not labored at the building of the great ship and those who had mocked the builders came quickly to the place where it was lying. They climbed upon the ship and beat upon it with their hands, they raged and pleaded, but could not enter inside, nor could they break the wood. As the great ship was borne up by the waters it rolled and they were swept off, for there was no foothold for them. The ship was lifted by the mighty surge of waters and hurled among the debris, but it was not dashed upon the mountainside because of the place where it was built. All the people not saved within the ship were swallowed up in the midst of raging confusion, and their wickedness and corruption was purged away from the face of the earth. The swelling waters swept up to the mountain top and filled the valleys. They did not rise like water poured into a bowl, but came in great surging torrents, but when the tumult quietened and the waters became still, they stood no more than 3 cubits above the earth. The destroyer passed away into the fastness of heaven and the great flood remained 7 days, diminishing day by day as the waters drained away to their places. Then the waters spread out calmly and the great ship drifted amid a brown scum and debris of all kinds. After many days the great ship came to rest upon Cardo, in the mountains of Ashta, against Nishim in the land of God.